head into the Ringerverse to stay up to date with all things superheroes and nerd culture entertainment. Hosted by a rotating lineup of superfans at The Ringer, including Mallory Rubin and Van Lathan, shows will provide instant reactions to blockbuster releases, insightful backstories on canon, and mind-bending theories, as well as fresh takes on the latest news and rumors. Check out The Ringerverse on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Mint Mobile. If you've had it with your overpriced wireless plan with its insanely high monthly bill and unexpected overages, then listen to this. For a limited time, wireless plans from Mint Mobile are $15 a month when you purchase a three-month plan. That's unlimited talk, text, and data for $15 a month. Wow, right? To get this new customer offer, just go to mintmobile.com/watch. That's mintmobile.com/watch. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first three-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for more details.
This episode is brought to you by Anytime Fitness. We're not all professional athletes, but we all have health goals. That's why Anytime Fitness gives you access to personalized plans and support from a coach. Plus, you can track your training, nutrition, and recovery progress with the Anytime Fitness app, just like the pros. With 24/7 access to more than 5,000 gyms worldwide, get more from your gym membership. Visit anytimefitness.com to try it for free today. Terms, conditions, restrictions all apply. See website for details.
I need support staff to clear the room.
Stand up and walk. Now.
Hello and welcome to The Watch. My name is Chris Ryan. I am an editor at TheRigger.com, and joining me on the other line, the Hoogie King of Southeastern Pennsylvania, it's Anna Greenwald!
Oh! Just here licking a water ice.
Yo, hun! I hope people are ready, because for the next 6 weeks, this is how Andy and I are talking. We are so excited, because today on The Watch, we were joined by the star of Mayor of Easttown, Kate Winslet.
And that was pretty crazy.
That was an emotional experience for us because Kate Winslet is obviously an Oscar award-winning actress. She's one of the great actresses of her generation. And she is playing in The Mayor of Easttown, mm-hmm. a police detective from Southeastern Pennsylvania with an accent that anybody with me and Andy's upbringing recognizes as nothing short of just the sound of home. And so we're so excited to talk to her. We'll be talking to her in the second half of today's episode. But first, we're going to get into Top Chef. Greenwald, how are you? Happy Thursday. It's Thursday afternoon, but we'll be putting this up on Friday morning.
I mean, I'm still hung up on this idea. The way you phrased it, and we will get back to Mayor of Easttown later in the show and to Kate, Oscar winning Kate Winslet, first Oscar winner ever on The Watch. Obviously, people have pointed out Ethan Hawke should have won an Oscar, but that's not right for us to decide. The way you phrased it is very powerful because I don't know what the antecedent would be like. What if in the 80s, John Gielgud flew into town to play the guy with a diamond in his beard from the local
jewelry
commercials?
If John Gielgud took over the role of Rocky's trainer, right?
Right. 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 But it's pretty unprecedented for the music of our youth, let's say, to be played on a Stradivarius. And that's what the show does for us. But we'll come back to it, right? Because right now we're going to talk... you want to talk about your dreams? You want to talk about horses? Or should we focus on the fact that we have a good show today?
We've really emptied the journals on people over the last couple of days. We can just get through this episode of Top Chef. It was episode 3 of season 18.
Thrilled to do it.
We had Mina on last week. It was so wonderful to talk to her about the show.
Deafening silence from Mina this week, now that the Sixers have taken over first place in the East.
Don't get into jinx territory, right? We didn't score in the last 8 minutes of that game, and we almost lost to Nick Claxton and Alizé Johnson.
That doesn't matter. Scoreboard. That's what I'm about. Okay. I'm a results guy.
That's right. Not a process guy as a Sixers
fan. I'm not even a watch the games guy. People know that.
All right. So let's talk about Top Chef. I asked you when we watched it, what were your feelings on it? And if I may jump in front of you here.
Please.
To set you up, really. Mm-hmm. You said Top Chef at its best.
Yes.
Tell me all
about
it.
TC back. Well, I think there's two cases to be made for this episode as one of the best in recent memory. And I think the easy first reason is that this was an inspiring challenge that took advantage of both location, which we were excited to see because we were a little concerned that wasn't going to be possible during this pandemic-produced season. But also took us on a journey culinarily and culturally, which I think Top Chef has increasingly become comfortable doing. And the result was a whole bunch of inspired chefs cooking their asses off. And,
I mean,
you know,
Talenti layers will do that to you.
Well, we're coming to that. We will talk about that. That was Top Chef at its worst, and we will speak on it. But as people know, I think, especially longtime fans of the show, this show is at its best when the chefs are at their best. It's really not as fun as you would think to see a lot of people fall flat on their faces. And so the degree to which people stepped up but also felt emotionally invested in the challenge, that generally results in great television. The second thing that I'll say is, as a long-term fan of Top Chef, this was the almost revelatory reward for watching a show evolve over the last few seasons. This episode would have been absolutely unfathomable to a fan of this program 3 years ago, 5 years ago, certainly 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. We've talked piece by piece as we've gotten into this show over the last year and a half about how a lot of the traditional metrics with which the Top Chef and its judges used to judge contestants have been inverted. This was the high point of that inversion and why it existed, I would say. And what I mean by that is, you know, we were talking obviously about how the show now definitely places a premium on personal stories, yourself on a plate, as opposed to, you know, technically correct risotto or whatever. But the bigger thing was, and chefs commented on it in the episode, just a year or two ago, the idea of making every chef early in the season learn about, appreciate, and attempt to do justice to the food of the African diaspora would have been absolutely unheard of.
So to give an example of what Andy's talking about, it was just last season that Eric and Brian Voltaggio were sitting on the steps of, I think, the Walt Disney Concert Hall. Mm-hmm. And Eric was like, this is the food I want to cook. And Brian was like, okay, like, tell me all about it. Like, let's figure out how to do this. Am I remembering this correctly?
That was the inflection point. That was when the show Top Chef had been turning into, it became the show that it now was. And I think it's for the good of everyone. The audience, the show, the cooks. Yes, that was
but
the moment.
But not only was that like you're calling it an inflection point, like the cast of the show feels and looks different.
Totally
and
different.
When they offer up a challenge like this, half a dozen chefs are like, I get it. Like, this is my story. This is my cooking. This is my family. Let's do this.
The show, you know, I think in many ways, this comment might actually get broader than I intended it to. I'll start by saying this. Like, I think that in many ways, the journey of Top Chef mirrors a journey a lot of well-intentioned liberal people have gone on in the last few years, which is to say, if you're looking for a certain type, if you're looking for a certain curiosity and openness towards culture and towards breaking down boundaries and using food as a vehicle to do that, I think the show has always been aligned with that idea, at least in principle, or at least in the broad strokes. But to your point, Chris, the collection of chef testants hasn't really reflected that often. The judges haven't always reflected it. It has been aspirational, but not actually put into practice. And when you see an episode like this, it's not just that they wouldn't have done a challenge like this where the chefs are, you know, visit these beautiful spots where they cook Guyanese food or Jamaican food and have to do justice to them. It's not just that they wouldn't have done that. It's that they just couldn't have pulled it off on any number of levels, one of which is it would have felt hollow if they had trotted out the same assortment of Voltaggios, sorry to paint with a broad stroke brush, but that's where we are, to do that and then have them be judged by Tom and Wolfgang Puck or Emeril or whomever. The show has put itself in a position to lead by example, I think, and have an incredibly diverse cast, as you pointed out, many of whom were not just excited and intrigued by the challenge, but felt personally seen by the opportunities of the challenge.
About like where they were going to eat and what they were given the opportunity to cook in the final elimination challenge.
And the show has also correctly, I think, both for TV reasons and food reasons, empowered Gregory and Kwame to be kind of ambassadors to the community. I meant specifically like the Black American Foodways community, but also could it be the community of Portland? It could be the community of viewers. And the whole thing felt earned in a way that was that was really exciting. It was really something. And we saw that reflected in, you know, the sort of the personal details and stories, and also ultimately in the winner's circle.
Yeah. A couple of notes. One, you're absolutely right about Kwame and Gregory being the basically the voices of the show this season. They've obviously had, I think, more to do with shaping how the viewer feels about the food being cooked than Tom or Gail or Padma.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And
I would also say that when you bring in this kind of emotion, it becomes a different television experience, for better and for worse. You know what I mean? Like, I definitely was like gripping the armrests pretty tight as we went into the elimination. And it's just like they gave Kiki an edit that was basically like her in tears for half of the episode about how important it was for her to be able to reflect her family heritage in her food. And to have her in the bottom three, you're just like, oh my God, man. Like, it's not the same thing as watching like Avishar maybe go home on like carbonating some grapes. You know what I mean? Like, it's definitely like very loaded at the end.
It is. And I would take it a step further to say that's also one of the things that made it so compelling and interesting, because the reason she was on the bottom wasn't because the flavors were off, or her understanding of the cultural traditions that led to this type of seasoning or this type of preparation were misguided, or she didn't listen to the challenge. She was in the bottom because of a technical error.
Yeah.
But it was the kind of technical error that the top chef of 2, 5, 9 years ago wouldn't have even had a comment on, because it was about how she prepared fufu. Now, fufu has made earlier appearances on Top Chef, but it was never treated the way it was treated in this episode, which is as a staple grain that is understood and ought to be a certain way. This wasn't food tourism. In a way, what came back and bit Kiki in this episode, thankfully not for good, was the same sort of thing that would have tripped up Harold Dieterle in season one if he didn't sear something correctly.
That's a deep cut you just got there.
And big fan of Harold. Well, because last week, Mina and I were talking about his restaurant, Perilla, RIP, yeah. Great spot. And what I'm trying to articulate was, there was a lot of intersectionality at work here in a way that
awesome.
Was really compelling, yeah. And really fascinating, you know, and who ended up on the top wasn't necessarily who you would have expected. Who ended up on the bottom wasn't necessarily who you expected. And the good naturedness and grace with which all of the people involved in this show handled the collision of perspectives, cultures, attitudes was really uplifting, frankly, but also kind of inspiring, you know, because you read sometimes about this that, and it's a cliche, that if you can break bread with someone, you can find a way to get along, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I guess a less pat way of saying that is that through food, we might be able to have some of the more uncomfortable conversations that we ought to be having. It's a more familiar way to get into it about things that might otherwise be difficult to articulate. And this whole episode kind of articulated that idea in a way that was really compelling.
It was really cool. I didn't think it was any kind of fake humility, but they also didn't dwell on any of the more, not humiliating moments, but like Gabe from Portland being like, I can't believe I've never been here, when I think he goes to Akadi and he's just like, I didn't even know about this restaurant, and he's in the city that it's in. And it didn't nail him for it. It didn't dwell on it. Like, look at this corn dog. Like, he doesn't know. It's just like, but like, look, like it's a big world. There's a lot of different places out there. Top Chef, more than anything, has contributed to our idea of what a restaurant should look like, feel like, what it should serve, the way you should eat there. And it was awesome to get like a different mode of experience there.
Absolutely. And look, you know, nobody needs to listen to this podcast to hear us stand up for the white chefs here. But I thought that Brittany and Gabe, to their credit or to the editor's credit, played the fools occasionally appropriately and well. You know what I mean? And Brittany being like, I can't handle spicy food. And Kwame being like, it doesn't have to be spicy. You just need to season it.
Right.
That's an instructive moment. And it was handled with, I thought, at least in terms of how we viewed it, with relative grace and goodwill and good spirit on both sides. You know, I don't think, and to take that a step further, Shota's success here in this challenge is also really significant. Particularly Shota's, though, I want to say, because this idea of spicy food or whatever, like, yeah, Japanese food generally is not spicy at all. I mean, these are spices that are just not present in that cuisine. But because he is a really, really, really talented chef, he was like, I understand intuitively how to appreciate something and integrate it and end up with something that is respectful all around. So, I mean, I was dazzled by all the little moments that led up to an overall entertaining episode. We could get back into the weeds of the you know,
we can work
the elimination challenge.
I just want to say, I want to say shout out Dawn.
Oh, wait, let's end up with Dawn because I want to shout out her at the end because she deserves it. I think we should start with the quick fire, but also with one moment before it that I just want to flag.
Okay.
Which is, and you may have missed it because I don't know if maybe you guys are like this too, but generally when I sit down to watch Top Chef, I mean, there's a settling in period. There's the previously on, there's the, you know, the San Pellegrino's giving you this much money. There's the weirdly chosen cover of Food and Wine magazine that's just like, chicken, it's great. So you, maybe you're still like, you know, getting a snack or adjusting a blanket on your couch or whatever. So you may have missed the moment in the like, let's get ready for today montage where our boy Avishar was shaving himself with a straight razor, like either Al Swearingen or Keith Murray in a Def Squad video from the 90s.
Yeah, I thought that that was an incredible moment. I wish that there was a little bit more, and I would imagine COVID protocols have kind of changed this, that like we had a little bit more living all over each other footage and talking to one another. Because Avishar, who I would not call, like I never noticed his facial hair before, because
you know why?
He uses Excalibur to fucking shave it off his face every morning. Like, and he's apparently like got Al Capone's male hygiene regimen.
I didn't realize that knife skills extended into the living and domestic space on the show.
Real talk. Do you think you would live through a straight razor shave if you gave it to yourself? Do you, or do you think the jugular goes first?
Oh, I would just end it early. Like, why draw out the suspense? My guy was treating his neck the way prisoners in Goodfellas treat garlic cloves. Like, it was just effortless
thin,
to him.
Baby.
He is running up my big board quick because of that. So
Avishar,
I had to
great
talk
moment
that.
There. And then Avishar continues to be the center of attention because for the second straight challenge between the elimination last episode and into the quickfire this episode, he, I think, brings a, I don't know, I wouldn't necessarily call it molecular gastronomy, but like a certain
scientific
flair to his cooking. And he made a local delicacy from where he's from in Columbus, called a Buckeye. It was the first time I'd ever heard of this, which is essentially like a peanut butter bomb. And I thought, given Padma's reaction to the peanut butter bomb, I was like, this dude is done for. You know what I mean? She just looked like unhappy with the bite.
Looked very unhappy with the bite. It also, I don't know whether it's the, we've just been spending a lot of time with these people or they're, you know, they're quarantined, but I was just like, it's probably 8 in the morning and they have to eat 15 desserts.
Yes. Yeah. I don't think I've ever noticed before someone get dinged the way Maria did for portion size.
Yeah. Also, that was an insane portion. And she did it again in the elimination challenge too. She just serves like a crock pot.
She had that misfortune of going last though. Right.
Still, though, it was a crock pot full of pureed beans.
Yeah.
I mean, that was
like the first time also heard the judges like cry uncle. And Tom was just basically like, this is really good, but I'm full.
I mean, we're skipping ahead, but that I agree with you. It was exciting, the fact that they loved all the food that much, that they were eating enough to be full. But back to the beginning, I mean, it was a roller coaster because Avishar demonstrating that he belongs on Peaky Blinders was such a riveting beginning. And then my hopes and dreams fell off a cliff when they're like, it's a dessert challenge. Not only is it a dessert challenge, but it is a branded dessert challenge. These are the two things that, you know, take your Buckeye peanut butter bomb. These are two tastes that do not taste good together as far as I'm concerned.
Are you a big Talenti guy?
I have no opinion on the matter.
Okay.
Are you?
No, I mean, I'm not a Talenti guy, but it's never like the thing I reach for.
Could you be if they were interested in podcast sponsorships?
Look, I'm available. You know what I mean? Like, I think that that's the thing is like, I believe that we're trying to reopen businesses in this country. So as a business, I'm open. If you want me to change my name to Chrissy Talenti, we can talk about it.
You're open to it. Anything is possible. That said, yes, I was impressed with Avishar and surprised at the result going by Padma's reaction. But the main takeaway for me from that opening was Sarah is an assassin. Like,
yes.
The shtick lasted an episode, right? I don't mean her shtick.
I mean,
the way the show
is
presenting her.
Yeah.
She is absolutely on another level. And the fact that she wasn't in the final three for the elimination challenge just says how good those three dishes were, because her dish looked amazing and it was spoken of reverently. And yeah, she is on that Paul in Texas, Melissa last season level already, where she's just half-assedly tossing out things that other people can't dream of. I mean, no one else even attempted to bake anything.
Do you think that her gameplay style rather than her cooking needs to change? This is the thing that Top Chef doesn't really take into consideration so much, which is like, it's on the plate. And especially, this is a very interesting comment that I think Kwame made. I can't remember about whom. I think maybe Nelson, where he was like, he keeps serving us the same thing, basically, if I remember correctly. Yeah. And it's pretty rare on Top Chef that you hear anything but a like sort of new criticism review of the food.
Like, you mean text-only, text-based?
Yeah, like I think that they try to go in blind on stuff to some extent. They don't really, I mean, like, yes, I remember Pava saying to, God, who is the guy who does Union in Pasadena? And I think that she would always ding him for his for doing pasta all the time. You know, people
I can picture him.
Yeah, like people have been like called out on that like sort of repetition before. But for the most part, I think like you can kind of cook your food and as long as that plate's good, you're good. It was interesting to hear like some, hey, you know, like this is the third time we've had this kind of food or this is the second time we've had this kind of food.
Like a space shuttle launch, I think there are three breakaway moments over the course of a Top Chef season. I think the first breakaway in terms of separation is the people who just, there's some people who just can't hang, can't cut it, whether they make mental errors early or they just aren't as good or creative
they're
a
not
chef
there yet.
As
yes.
the others. Yeah. And they tend to fall away early on. The next separation, I think, are the people who can play the game, you know, and make the right choices, whether it's where they should be in restaurant wars or, you know, cleverly use the ingredients and take advantage of the opportunities to either jump ahead or kind of stay in the mushy middle. Mm-hmm. And then the final separation are the people who let the game come to them. And they're people who, no matter what occurs, what comes up, what difficulty they're presented with, they effortlessly integrate the ingredients, the context, the challenge into their own cooking and worldview. And that is what we are seeing so far from Shota and Sarah, without question. And it's what we saw last season with Gregory most of the way, with Melissa, obviously, all the way into the end. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's a lot of people kind of in that middle, and we're not really sure yet. But the early signs of that kind of separation are creeping up where, yeah, like Nelson seems awesome, but he also hasn't really stepped it up. And we can speak about Chris whenever, but he's another one who seems like he's technically skilled enough to be there, certainly.
Sure.
But there's that, whether it's a mental block or whether it's where he is in his development, it is not all happening,
together. Sometimes it's a matter of like having the skills and technique, but not having the imagination to go with it. I think Brittany has a lot of character, and I think that I would love to eat her food, but like didn't necessarily have the mindset going into this episode. Like even early on, I think it was like, because she was also, I believe she was in the bottom three.
She was shaken up last time. She started the episode crying because she felt that it was unfair that Sasha went home for something they did together.
Right. So, you know, I mean, like we've seen people kind of claw their way back from those kinds of situations, but I almost felt like Brittany was saying in the kitchen in the elimination challenge, and then once she got to the judges' table, like she was like almost saying like, I'm not ready for this yet.
Yeah, I mean the intensity of the show can be such that when you are talking to the judging table at the end, it can feel like therapy. I mean, these people are broken down and exhausted even this early on. And she was literally just like, I don't know who I am or why I'm a cook. I mean, that was when she was done for the judges. Personally, the red flag for me was when she was like, I'm really not sure what to do. I'm torn between my German side and my Southern side. And I got to say, the Semitic side of me was like, that's a real Sophie's choice here. You know what I mean? Like, I think I'll just let you just choose yourself and I'll go over to the other side. That's fine. Not going to mess with either of those sides.
Let's talk about Dawn a little bit. I think we could go through, I don't know if you had a lot of elimination notes.
No, I mean, just that I love the whole challenge. I love it when they go into a community.
The restaurant tour was awesome.
But
on top also,
of that,
I thought it was really cool because clearly if they're doing these kinds of visits, there's a lot of protocols that go into it.
Yes.
So I think any effort that they make to go out into the world, it probably costs them in production. It probably is quite a logistical like kind of undertaking. Yeah. And I thought it was dope that the Akadi and Matilda's and these places were like the ones that they showed.
I think it was Herculean to do that and bring everyone together.
That was a big full restaurant that they were eating in.
Yeah. So I think you're right to point that out. I mean, the challenge of doing that, and they obviously I mean, we don't know yet, but I would guess they don't have a lot of those in the chamber for a season.
I imagine we might not see that until Restaurant Wars.
Yes. And so I was really glad they did it. They did it here. I also want to flag, we don't often talk about bravery on Top Chef, but Kwame walking to the restaurant and then eating curry goat and dipping food in red stew wearing that fit.
I can't do it. Do you know how bad I've gotten?
That was incredible.
So this is where I'm at in this whole process of our lives since last March. Yeah. Is like, I will sometimes summon, if not the courage, the moment of inspiration where I'm like, I'm going to put on a shirt with buttons.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, I think I might dress up to sit down to dinner with my wife or something. And then there is like an inevitable thing where I put it on and first of all, I'm like, I look and feel weird. Second of all, I'm like, there is now a 9 out of 10 chance that something I'm eating is going to wind up on this shirt. I just have no concept of what's clean anymore. I essentially wear and wash the same sweatshirt every single day.
Mm-hmm.
And like, so Kwame being there and having the just utter grail shit that he is wearing, and then he's just like, we're going in, is like one of the great performances of the last year I've seen.
Yeah, I find myself more and more often.
I can't get through a dinner wearing like a Gap shirt. You know what I mean?
Yes. Maybe I'm regressing, but I feel on the same emotional and just feeding myself level that I felt in when I was 3 years old, and the only button-down dress shirts I knew were the ones that I was allowed to take from my father's closet that he didn't wear to use as a smock in preschool. Like, I am about smock life at this point.
Yeah.
I do not trust myself or my hands in just the simple act of self-sustenance. So that was a wild performance by him. But frankly, everyone, and maybe this is because they had been quarantined up to this point, but everyone looks incredible. The judges, like Amar is wearing these just wild out pants. I mean, good for them. Good for them. Celebrate, be your best selves on TV. Good work. So, but on to the challenge. It was a wild one. It was, as we said,
Did they have 90 minutes to cook? 2 hours to cook?
Yeah, but I don't know how many. One question I had was, it's never clear how many plates they're making, because as you said, it was a very full restaurant. And often when they have to do like 200 covers and they have like 8 hours or whatever, they make an issue of that. So I couldn't tell if they were really making enough plates for all of those people.
20 dishes for people? Yeah, right.
Or because everyone was, I guess, you know, PCR'd before sitting down, did they just drop a plate in the middle of each table and was like,
no,
go
they
for
were
it.
Serving individual plates. I wonder whether or not certain tables got certain dishes and then the judges' table got all the dishes. Do you know what I mean? But yeah, I did the thing that was interesting.
By the way, what a flex they have this season with this recurring panel where Melissa, who, as everybody knows, not just because she was on this podcast, we think is amazing and a star and is a crucial voice and a judge now, just is at table 9. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And just like occasionally the camera finds her to be like, this is impressive. And everybody stops and listens. Like she's not even in the circle for this episode.
What did you think of Blaze going from 35 feet?
I respected Blaze.
I was like, what are you going to say? Oh my God.
I mean, Blaze
just pulled up double covered. They were trying to trap him. And he was like, no.
No, I am who you thought I was, and I'm going to be that guy. I mean, I kind of respected it. You know, there was a moment, too, at the end when I think Kwame was like, to Don, he was like, in addition to winning this challenge and making incredible food, and we'd all like to buy your jarred sauce, he was like, Don, you are making the ancestors proud. And then there's this cut to Tom being like, you know, and it's like, okay, all right.
For but I think, sure.
But that's kind of what I was getting at when I was talking about these like interesting opportunity to have potentially uncomfortable conversations. Like everybody was in on it. You know what I mean? And I think that the show found a balance, and obviously it can do better, and I'm sure it will do better. But everybody walking into that room is aware that Top Chef hasn't done this before, that a lot of these judges or like Richard Blaze has not. Richard Blaze probably doesn't know what fufu is supposed to taste like. You know what I mean? And I bet he would admit that as well. And so, well, I don't know how that line of his was received truly in the room, like, okay, he said it. And then what? You know? And, I kind of appreciated that.
An amazing time for white guys to be like, I'll say it. I'll say it. It's like, just, dude.
The elephant in the room. Yeah.
I just want to say, so we could, we usually wrap these conversations about, did you want to hit anything else before we get to sort of like the final notes here?
No, I think we should get to the final, like the winners and losers circle.
Yeah. No, I mean, like, obviously that was like one of the most intense bottom threes I can remember seeing. So it was Kiki, Chris, and Brittany. It's really hard to, you know, I after watching all these seasons, I'm sure you feel the same way. They still do a pretty good job of, like, you know, fainting one way and you think, oh my gosh, like, it really sounds like they're going to send Chris home here, you know, and then it's Brittany. But, you know, I thought that was a pretty intense one. Obviously Kiki, her sort of emotional relationship with the episode was such that, like, you know, it was really like watching behind your fingers to like make sure she got through it. Okay.
I thought they handled that fairly well in terms of the emotional journey that she was going through over the course of the episode and why. Ultimately, I never fell for it. I didn't think she was going home because generally when you're trying to figure out who's actually going to be eliminated, if they've praised any aspect of the dish, they're probably safe.
Yeah. And, you know? And it sounds like her stew was very good. What's underneath is fine. It's just the foo-foo. Yeah, right.
That said, I was pretty sure Chris was going home, except for the fact that they were like, you're here to cook, so cook, which suggested a future for him. Because, you know, it's important to say that I'm praising Top Chef for starting some interesting conversations about race and food and American culture and intersectionality, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The show is not finishing these conversations. And so when Chris, a black man, is like, I'm kind of in a bubble in New Hampshire and I grew up eating some of this food, but I don't know how to cook it. So I'm going to do a technically correct French version of this. You could do a season of television about everything he's saying and about what's happening on that plate. So I guess for that reason alone, I'm kind of glad that he didn't go home, even though it seemed like the show was tipping in that direction, because I want to see him work some of this stuff out and talk about it. And I think it's fascinating to observe. And, you know, Brittany was a gracious foil in a way for being the person who's just like, not only have I never had this food, I'm sweating. Yikes. You know, it was an interesting counterpoint when she was just like, I'm not familiar with these and it tastes too bold for me. So I'm going to tamp it down. Yeah. Where Shota was like, this is too bold for me, but I'm just going for it.
Sure. Sure. So, Dawn wins the challenge. That is, two now. I think that she is at least, she's either one or she was in the top three, correct? Last time with the ribs.
Correct.
So Dawn is I think trending upwards. I would still probably put Shota and Sarah in a group of two, and then Dawn right there at three with Jamie, I think.
Yeah, Jamie's on the come up, which was exciting. Her dish looked amazing.
And you know, like, there's really little point in us doing these kinds of like power rankings, because technically speaking, you could fuck the dish up next week, and no matter how good you were, if you just had an absolute mare, you would have a hard time coming back. I think sometimes they cut some people breaks for like cumulative performance, but you know, Shota could completely S the bed next week and he could be gone.
Hard to imagine.
Hard to imagine.
Hard to imagine. Cause his floor is so, so, so high, you know? But in general, like I'm just pretty excited, not just for the quality of the cooking that we're seeing, but also the kind of crosstalk and cross currents, you know, when Maria, you know, is saying that I wanted tortillas, like this reminded me of Mexican food, you know, that's awesome. Let's have more opportunities to explore that, you know, and just this bold kind of uncharted future for this show and for cooking shows in general, where it's not about conforming the food that you know best into one box that everybody can identify and judge on the same level. It's not about that at all. It just feels like there are no boxes, and the show has embraced that. And Tom is nodding excitedly along with the ancestors. And I'm very curious where it's going to go next.
Let's talk a little bit about Mayor of Easttown. So this episode's going up on late Thursday night, early Friday morning. We obviously are going to talk to Kate Winslet about the show. I'll set the show up a little bit for people. Mm-hmm.
I think you can listen to this interview without.
Yeah.
So then watch Sunday's premiere.
Sunday, first episode drops Sunday. I'll just give you guys the sort of log line of what Mare of Easttown's about. It's about this woman named Mare, who's played by Kate Winslet, who is a police detective in a small town about, like, I would say 45 minutes west of where Villanova is. So it's Chester County. It's out like just about an hour west of Philadelphia. I have not spent a ton of time there, to be honest, in my life. I spent more time in New Jersey than other parts of Pennsylvania as a kid growing up in Philadelphia. But I do know towns like it from my experiences in Philadelphia. And I think that the way that they depict this town and some of the hardships that it's facing is incredibly accurate. So she is a police detective. She's a former high school basketball star turned police detective. She's kind of living in a state of perpetual faded glory and also cynicism because of that faded glory. And the show for, as obviously, because she's a police detective, we're going to have a central mystery. And I don't want to talk too much about the details of that central mystery because it sort of matters in terms of the first episode. I don't want to spoil anything. But I would say that this is one of the most human and observant and beautiful portraits, at least in the first episode, mm-hmm. of a town and of a group of people and of a community, even though they are under an incredible amount of economic stress, even though they are dealing with an opioid epidemic that's sweeping through the town, even though there's a lot of broken dreams, there's a lot of what I could have been versus what I wound up being. I felt like watching this first episode, and people will see Sunday night, like I immediately knew these people. I immediately felt like this was something that I hadn't seen before, and that the person who was making it, it's written by this guy named Brad Inglesby, knew exactly the story he was telling. You know, it's got a great cast. Gene Smart's in it. Guy Pearce is in it.
Julian Nicholson is great.
Julian Nicholson is amazing in it. But I don't know, Andy, what did you think? I mean, like, without giving anything away, I think they combine some of the best qualities of the kind of Broadchurch mystery model with a kind of like slice of life that we don't often see anymore.
A little bit like Happy Valley as well, another great UK crime series that I hopefully people have checked out. But and I would say in the sense that when you watch a show like that, usually a UK or European show, and it has such a specific sense of place, you kind of just wish someone could pull that off in America. And I guess it took an English actress like Kate Winslet to do it. But when you watch the show, and I hope everybody does, because like Chris said, it's so far anyway, it's just fantastic, and I absolutely loved it. You will immediately pick up on some darkness and heaviness that is just part and parcel of our TV culture these days, and particularly stories like this. But almost immediately, I hope you'll find, like I did, that it is wonderfully counterbalanced with a deep sense of warmth mm-hmm. and genuine heart and life underneath it. You know, it's not dark to be dark. It's the story of people who would much rather not be dark, having to get up, put on their boots, and deal with it again. And there are moments of real, real humor also in it, thanks primarily to Kate Winslet's performance. We talked to her about a little bit of it, whether it's for reasons that you'll see. She's limping extravagantly through parts of the episode. There's an incredible moment involving a can of spray cheese that apparently was improvised, as we learned from the great Oscar winner, Kate Winslet. So we're really all in on the show for any number of reasons, but obviously her performance is the anchor that kind of sells it right away.
Yeah, I would say it's an amazing ensemble, but it's kind of awesome to watch a TV show like this and see a rising, like the boat raise the tide rather than the tide raising all the boats. Or maybe mm-hmm. in this metaphor, Kate Winslet is the tide, but her performance is at such a level.
She's finally gotten revenge on the tide after Titanic.
That's right. And her mm-hmm. on-screen kind of magnetism is so intense that you're like, I'm watching one of the greats to ever do it get to stretch out over 6 hours and tell a story that I don't think would get made for film anymore. Or if it did, it would feel very compressed and it would be, I think, somewhat more cliched.
Do you think she will come back on our podcast after the way we kept asking her to use her Delco accent like a...
I think she seemed, as soon as she knew that we were from Philadelphia, I think she was a little shook because she was just like, the auditors are here, you know, the guardians of the galaxy are in the building.
There are no two icons more associated with the city of Philadelphia and its busted knuckle blue collar glory than the two of us.
Two guys who haven't been to Chester in 30 years. Yeah. All right. So why don't we can end it there. Andy and I will be back on Monday where we will be discussing the first episode of Mayor of Easttown. So please check that out on Sunday night. You will not regret it. We'll also probably touch on Falcon and Winter Soldier. More shows are coming. So we're excited to expand the palette beyond Marvel. And yeah, let's get into our interview with Kate Winslet.
This episode is brought to you by Mint Mobile. If you've had it with your overpriced wireless plan with its insanely high monthly bill and unexpected overages, then listen to this. For a limited time, wireless plans from Mint Mobile are $15 a month when you purchase a three-month plan. That's unlimited talk, text, and data for $15 a month. Wow, right? To get this new customer offer, just go to mintmobile.com/watch. That's mintmobile.com/watch. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first three-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for more details.
This episode is brought to you by Major League Baseball. A lot is going on in the world of sports right now, but don't forget the 2024 baseball season. It's officially here. Some pretty exciting things to look forward to. Can the star-studded Dodgers, can they make the World Series? Can Mookie Betts break my heart again? How about the young Orioles? How about the defending champs, the Rangers, trying to become the first back-to-back champs in over two decades? See how far they'll go. Get in on the action by visiting your local ballpark or any ballpark, or you can just go to MLB.com. Tap the banner to learn more. Baseball is something else. This episode is brought to you by UGG. Y'all know UGG is a brand that athletes wear all the time in the tunnel and on travel days. Well, I bet you think UGG season is only during the colder months of the year. Au contraire, you're wrong. You need to check out the latest spring drop from UGG. They have everything from sandals to clogs. I like the sandals. UGG has you covered for your next spring adventure. Shop the Golden Collection at UGG. This episode is brought to you by Cars.com. When you add your car to your garage on Cars.com, you'll unlock access to real-time insights into how much your car is worth. Plus, view its historical and projected value to decide when to sell. So when the time is right, you can secure an instant offer from a local dealership or sell it yourself on Cars.com. Start tracking your car's value with your garage on Cars.com.
Hey, how are you?
Hi. Very good, thank you. So is that an actual beer bottle or is it an ornament behind your head?
It is a prop beer bottle from a TV show I made. But you should know, relevant to your show, it was originally a Yingling, which we are both from Philadelphia, and we were so thrilled to see screen.
This is going to be largely a conversation about Southeastern Pennsylvania beer choices, so I hope you're...
I don't know how much that you've had already today, but...
Well, actually, beer choices, I don't know how much we've covered, but Yingling and what else? What are the other beers that
Rolling
we had?
Rock. Yeah, Rolling Rock.
I get it.
You were a Rolling Rock household. That was a bold choice, and it differentiated you immediately.
Rolling Rock household. I know. And there was much discussion about the Rolling Rock because it was another beer at one point as well that I think we couldn't get clearance on or something. Anyway, so yeah, Rolling Rock and a shot of Jameson.
Rolling Rock is available, I think. We just cleared them for this podcast just moments
ago. Okay, few good. Okay.
So we've already started, but we'll get into it again. We are overjoyed and thrilled and honored to have Kate Winslet on the podcast. The first Oscar winner ever to be on this podcast after 9 years. Usually we have participation trophy recipients.
Yeah.
Oh my God, how exciting. Wow, that's a very big deal. Oh, yes. Thank you for having me.
And we are both huge fans of you as an actor, but particularly of this show and this role, not only because we are from Southeastern Pennsylvania as well. And we're excited to talk to you about it. And since we have limited time, I want to jump in and ask you specifically about the process of becoming mayor, the titular mayor of Easttown. And I'm wondering if there was, and maybe this isn't how you work, but if there was a singular moment when you felt it snap into place, and whether it may have been the wardrobe, because there's incredible flannels on display from the beginning.
Oh, I know, they're great.
Whether it was the locations when you were actually, you know, in Southeastern Pennsylvania with Wawa signs in the distance, or was it when the cameras were rolling and you uncorked that first overdose? Because that's when it came alive for us.
Oh my God. Okay, so did I nail the dialect then?
Yes.
It was thrilling. Yes. It was our love language. Truly.
Oh my God, I'm so happy. You can't imagine. Like, I think I probably felt, you know, I think I probably felt the most truly mayor ever when, because she's so sort of disgusting and yet charming. And, you know, she's lovable, but she's loathsome. She's strong, but she's vulnerable. You know, she's morally incredibly sound and then morally extraordinarily corrupt all at the same time. But I think for me, you know, some of the more mayor moments were the private ones when she's on duty on the phone and eating in the car with her mouth full. Like these are some of the, like these were just, these were just glorious moments to get to play. And truly, like, she became an alter ego for me. And I want to say this out loud now publicly, and I hope this goes far. I am much more like Mare of Easttown than I am any character I've any played in any British period drama. Fact, okay? Fact. My mouth is almost as filthy as Mare's. Actually, possibly even slightly more so. And I'm no stranger to a bottle of beer, newsflash. You see?
You know, you wouldn't think that of me.
You'd think I was like some little dainty champagne sipping. No, no. I'm chips, cheese, and beer, believe me.
I don't remember the scene of you eating like a scrapple and egg roll on horseback in Sense and Sensibility, but it would have brought it brought it more into focus, I think.
I know, as would have been, you know, me putting Cheese Whiz onto the cheese ball and piling up as high as I could, which was my idea, by the way, added on the day. They had to go out and get extra Cheese Whiz. Because I did it so many times, I destroyed several bottles of that stuff.
That looks as comfortable as I have ever seen anyone on camera with you with 2 feet up on the table, a bottle of ice cold beer, and a ball of cheese. Like, you seemed incredibly in the pocket there. And I was wondering whether or not, at what point did you start adding on to Mare? Like, at what point were you like, she should be eating cheese in this scene, or she should be doing this in the scene? Like, how much of it, when you first started getting like sort of the feel for the character, did you start embellishing in with ideas of your own?
That it kind of happened. Like, I feel like as soon as I got to Delco and started really piecing the character together in terms of costume fittings and really how she would look, you know, that 4 inches of regrowth in her hair where, you know, she just has not colored it for 2 years. You know, little things like that made a difference, you know, the vape, you know, just the mess, the chaos of her, the fact that she wears that barn jacket with a hoodie underneath, but it's really one item of clothing, you know, like those two things were melded together by God knows what. And the food, you know, the food and the drink aspect of Mare played a really huge part as well. And I just, yeah, I embellished and added all along the way, you know, particularly Jean Smart and I, you know, yes, we had an incredible script written by Brad Inglesby, who is from that area. And he was just terrific being there every single day and letting us change things and play around. But Jean Smart and myself, you know, Mare and Helen, her mother, you know, their relationship is caustic at times. And they throw these verbal grenades at one another. And believe me, Jean and I just had so much fun. And we added things every day, you know, every day there was, you know, another curse word thrown into a scene. And it was so much, you know, really was just fantastic.
I love that you mentioned the two-tone hair. That was the moment when my wife gasped when we get the full shot of that. And that was when I knew we were both hooked for the duration of the series.
Yeah, my wife was like, only Kate Winslet can pull off those roots.
Well, it wasn't an accident, you know, it was a heavily thought through process. And actually, when you do see Mare in flashback, which without giving anything away, we do see, you know, it's a freshly colored head of hair. And, you know, we wanted to make that distinction because obviously so much happens in her life that is backstory that amounts to essentially who Mare is in the present day and sort of informs pretty much every action that she takes and every breath that she takes as well. And, you know, that's what I love about the show is that, yes, it's set in a small town and there is a murder that needs to be solved at the heart of it. But it is very much about community and family and shared history that you have with people and regret and forgiveness. And it's messy and complicated in the way that a lot of, you know, real small towns actually are. I mean, that's what it's like where I grew up. And for most people I know, it's similar.
I think that's what probably Chris and I both responded to very much, which is that we are both big fans of detective stories on page and on the screen. And what really separates them is when there is a truly specific sense of place and of life overlapping and layers of society just bumping up against each other. And the show is full of that. And as you mentioned, the creator is from the area and you can tell. But I am curious, Kate, as you approach the role, you mentioned you arrived in Delco. Again, musical words to the two of us. As someone who has worked all around the world, I know you lived in New York for a long period of time. Did this region register for you? I mean, did you have a perception of a very specific place, sense of spirit of Philadelphia or its environs? And how did you go about educating yourself to play this part?
I mean, I have to say, like, I did live in Manhattan, as you say, for 10 years and never once got on a train and went to Philadelphia, which I just, it's so absurd and wrong now that I have spent time there.
And everyone in Philadelphia spends all their time thinking about New York angrily, and everyone in New York never thinks about Philadelphia at all. That's the relationship.
Well, I feel bad that I bought into any one of those demographics, frankly. But Philly, I mean, I loved it there. I experienced many a pretzel and many, you know, tubes of mustard. I can tell you that. It's a special place, you know, these townships that are filled with, you know, people for whom their homes are very important and community really means a huge, huge amount. And you can feel that. It's a very sort of palpable energy that I think you get from the place. And it was something that we really wanted to make sure we put into the show, because it is the heartbeat of the story is East Town itself. And spending time with those people and really getting to know a lot of locals and working with East Town Police Department and Marple Township Police Department, you know, there are people there to whom I am indebted forever because they helped us so much, in particular me, with the creation of Mare and the detective-y side of Mare, as we would call it. It was an amazing time. I loved it. I really loved it. I miss playing her. Like, it's crazy. I wrote to Brad Inglesby, our writer and showrunner, the other day, and I was like, oh my God, I think I really miss Mare. What are we going to do?
We have suggestions.
Yeah. Speaking of Brad, when you meet someone who obviously has such a personal connection to the geography of where the story is set and obviously... I would imagine themes from the story. How much of a difference does that make when you're working with someone where the work is obviously like carved out of them to some extent, rather than it's just like a pitch or it's a twist on this story that we've already heard? Like, this really does feel like a very personal work for everybody involved.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And for Brad, you know, he would often cite various different like family members or friends or memories or experiences he had as a kid that had absolutely inspired, you know, various different characters or themes within our show. And plus he has the accent as well. And so does his wife. And so having that available every single day was incredibly valuable and added such incredible depth and texture to the entire story and all of the characters within it. It was fantastic. It was just fantastic having that.
One of the things that impressed me the most about the piece, and I haven't seen all of it yet, but you can already tell from the beginning, is that while it deals with heavy subject matter, there's a darkness to it. It's a very painful end to the premiere episode that we won't spoil. Despite the darkness, there is and despite the cold, which is quite punishing, even though no one wears sensible hats, which does track with my experience growing up there. There's a persistence of, I don't know whether it's lightness, I don't know whether it's hope, maybe it's just sort of the warmth of humanity, or maybe it's just everyone being pushed up against each other in houses that abut each other. But there is something there that keeps the show from sort of subsuming itself in darkness, which I think is a problem with, frankly, with a lot of prestige television or whatever you want to call it in general. And I wonder if that's something that you were aware of as well from the beginning, and something that you and Brad and the rest of the team were conscious of and fought to preserve a sense of life amidst the creeping darkness.
Absolutely. That sense of life, that sense of shared history, that sense of, you know, people's backstories overlapping and intertwining. You know, we really built all of that because we, you know, you can't, as actors, you can't just show up and do the lines and expect for that character to be truthful. You know, there would have been a hollowness to the show if we had done that. So we did all spend a lot of time together. Rehearsal was very extensive. You know, whenever we'd have a new actor show up who hadn't worked with us yet, significant time would absolutely be spent with that actor to make sure that they felt really integrated into our world that we were creating. In terms of the brevity and the lightness and the humor that you're talking about, you know, a lot of that was absolutely written in by Brad, being very aware that, of course, we did need that, you know, and we put the audience through so much that you have to give them, you know, a few gags and a few laughs along the way. Craig Zobel, our director, was really the, like, you know, he was the person who would be like, we have to laugh now. Okay, I'm sad. I'm feeling sad. I want you to do something funny. So then Gene Smart and I would do something funny. And just wherever we could, really, we would add those touches of humor. Because even in the most distressing of scenarios, sometimes in life, you know, something odd or humorous can happen, and allowing the space for that so that we could either keep it or discard it in the edit was very important that we did that. And it's largely through, I think, Mare's relationship with food and drink, as well as Mare's relationship with her mother, that we're allowed to really see those things. And that's true, I think, also of mother-daughter relationships, which I know about and appreciate and was able to, you know, throw into the show as well.
I would also say her relationship with ambulatory movement, because the limp.
Yeah, the limp is great.
The limp is so real and so funny and so just persistent. It's just fantastic.
But it's just so annoying, isn't it? You know, it's just so annoying to have a limp like that. And it's such a dumb injury that did it. And I love the way that, you know, we did add this as well, that, you know, as soon as she gets into the house and she goes right to the freezer and she doesn't get out an ice pack, she gets out a bag of frozen mixed vegetables based on her ankle. And I remember getting there and props were like, so we have potato chips frozen, we have peas. I'm like, it's got to be mixed veg and they have to be diced and we have to see it on the packet. I know. Mare's going to turn into like a meme, isn't she? It's going to be...
I wouldn't be surprised.
We almost don't deserve her. I mean, it's too good.
I know. She is kind of great. I really miss her. It's terrible. I kept her barn jacket and it's on my like hook in the house. And, you know, and the other day I put it on and just like sat on the couch and my 17-year-old son turned to me and he was like, okay, you're scaring me. I'm like, oh, just for a minute. Just a moment. Just let me. Come on. He's like, okay, that's weird.
Just let me say hoagie one more time.
Yeah, I was wondering, do you have to, just because I haven't finished the series, but I don't want to spoil it for anybody, but Mare is an ex-basketball player. And do you have to develop an affinity for basketball and playing, even just to have that mentally in your head while you're playing the character? Or is that a bridge too far for you?
No, it was definitely not a bridge too far. But, you know, I've had three children. Like, you really want me to jump and land and not pee myself? Guys, you know, there are limits. I honestly didn't go and suddenly train in basketball. We do not see me play basketball in the show. I felt legitimately this was okay. However, it does say on page one of episode one, we meet Mare Sheehan, 40s, an ex-athlete, at which point I'm like, okay, loud curse word. That means I now have to like be an ex-athlete. So I did, you know, there were some things that I did up in terms of the exercise regime, which I have to be honest, in the end became kind of critical to me in playing her. So I became obsessed with my Peloton bike, absolutely obsessed. And I would every day I'd come home from work and that would be my sort of my releasey thing is I'd jump on my bike and would sometimes just scream and yell and cry and sweat for, you know, 45 minutes and stay fit. Hey, bonus.
Yeah.
Is it okay that we imagine you doing that with the Rocky theme playing? Is that a bridge too far, or is
no,
that appropriate?
Go there, okay. Right there and stay in that happy place.
So Chris is mentioning the basketball. I did want to mention one specific scene in the pilot that I just thought was really extraordinary. And it's the scene when you and the other four starters of this legendary high school basketball team are waiting in the wings to be introduced for this anniversary evening. And there's a great deal of tension and crosstalk and petty jealousies and much deeper emotions. And I just thought it was such a terrific window into a moment that we rarely see, where women, all of who have had very different lives, have accomplished a lot, or maybe not as much as they would have hoped. And within a second, they are back to who they always were. And they cannot escape the petty everythings that define them as teenagers. And it was really a powerful kind of moment and a powerful window into not just these characters, but the type of storytelling that I think Brad and you and the rest of the team wanted to tell.
Well, a lot of that, you know, that specific conversation that you're talking about was absolutely in the script. But there was a lot of embellishment, shall we say, from me, you know, just talking to Laurie. He's like, you love me. Yes, you do. You know, that was all added on the day, to the point that the camera crew who were doing a handheld shot would be just pissing themselves laughing. And I would be saying to them, guys, you can't laugh because then I'll laugh. You know, there's like a thing that you, there's an unspoken rule. You're not allowed to find me funny if I'm being funny, because then it will make me laugh and then it's not funny. So they were like, Kate, but it's so funny. So, but that is one of the things, though, that I do love about our story is that, you know, there's sort of like private windows on people's worlds, that behind the scenes stuff that really does entrench it so entirely in reality, in real life. You know, those are the conversations that do go on, that those shared overlapping histories that people have that you can never move away from or get rid of, and do absolutely shape the town that the show is set in, because of the people in it. You know, my parents would always say to me, it's people, not places. Mm-hmm. That's the most important thing in life, people, not places. And in this case, it's the people that make it the place that it is. And that, I think, is really quite standout and is the heartbeat of the show.
Yeah, well, we both love it. I mean, it's obviously, it hits very close to home for us, but it's really amazing to see such a very specific place get captured in such a universal way. So Kate, thanks so much for chatting with us today.
You're welcome. You've made me feel so good about our show.
It's so good. And we think there could be multiple seasons. That's the thing that you and Brad could talk about. And before you go, could we ask you to say hoagie one more time?
You get me a hoagie.
You're too kind. Thank you so much, Kate.
Thanks so
really
much.
Appreciate it.
That wasn't even very good how I just said hoagie.
You're welcome to do a sec take two.
Ready to find your next favorite podcast? Spotify makes it easier than ever to discover new favorites by previewing short audio clips before committing to a full listen. You can even watch some podcasts with video or just keep playing audio in the background. It's everything you want in one app. Music, podcasts, and audiobooks across any device. Play anytime, anywhere, any way you'd like with Spotify. Try today.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You might say all kinds of stuff when things go wrong, but these are the words you really need to remember. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. They've got options to fit your unique insurance needs, meaning you can talk to your agent to choose the coverage you need, have coverage options to protect the things you value most, file a claim right on the State Farm mobile app, and even reach a real person when you need to talk to someone. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.